Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. Who are the young adults in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? What do they think? What's their worldview? What do we know about them? And how do we relate to them? How do we help them relate to the world around them as Christians? We'll answer some of those questions or dig deeper to find out what are the questions to ask as we learn more about young adults of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family. You can find out more about them at our website, kfuo.org. Look for the Concordia University, Wisconsin logo in the sponsor section. To help us dig deeper into this topic of young adults in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I only have to go up one floor, talk with the person who's doing a lot of that research with a great team to figure out what questions to ask and how do we dig deeper into that topic. Juliana Schultz, fellow DCE and program manager for Lutheran Young Adult Corps in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Office of National Mission. Juliana, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Always fun to have you in studio. Love talking about what's going on with young adults. Excited about Lutheran Young Adult Corps as well.
Yes.
Applications all rolled in. Are they all in now?
And no, you still have 48 hours if you want to join our 10-month gap year program. You still have a couple of days.
So the time is now.
And the applications are available at lcms.org/YACORPS.
That's nice how I gave it. A little opportunity for a plug there.
I appreciate it.
10-month opportunities. It's kind of like a gap year thing.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. We can revisit that again at the end if you want to as well. Well, you brought along your team with you today.
Well, I'm not sure whose team this is. I think it might be Mark's team.
This is Mark's team. Mark Kiesling, the Reverend Mark Kiesling, Director of Youth Ministry, the LCMS Office of National Mission. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
Always fun to have you in studio. Yeah. We might laugh a little bit too much, perhaps, when we're all in the studio together. And speaking of laughing, one of the guys in the building that makes me laugh a lot, Ryan Kernutz, Senior Research Analyst, LCMS Research Offices. It's because he always keeps a very... like steady face.
Absolutely.
When I crack a joke. Ryan, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here. I'll try and be more animated as much as a statistician can be.
But, you know, when we start thinking about, say that we're going to talk about statistics today and numbers and things like that and research, some people might think, oh, that's not very exciting. I get excited about that because it helps us plan and think forward for the future of how we can serve one another, particularly how we can serve young adults in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and those beyond the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that we might reach them with the gospel as well. So what are we wanting to learn about young adults, Juliana?
I think for us, one of these big questions, and it continues to be a question in our church body, is why are some young adults retained from confirmation through high school and into adulthood? And why do we see this? We know statistically there's a large number of young adults who leave, and some return to the church and often some don't. And so we want to see what is it that is... what are the factors that play into a young adult who is retained in the church through adulthood? Or what are the factors that play into a young adult who maybe walks away from their faith in their early 20s and just never comes back?
Mm-hmm. Are there some trends among those?
Mm-hmm. And truly, are there things that we as a church can be pointing to and saying, these are things that are key factors that you need to be conscientious of, that you need to be actively pursuing in order to ensure that those young adults are a part of the church, not just now, but into the future?
Mm-hmm. What can we do to help them with those first article things that help them stay connected to Word and Sacrament Ministry, stay connected to a congregation, then the body of Christ, stay connected to the church. Well, where did you begin this adventure?
So for the entire lifetime of the National Youth Gathering, we've done an LYF youth poll that takes a large sampling of the young adults that are there at the gathering. That's been really successful in terms of giving us a wealth of information about the young adults who are active in the LCMS. And so this data that we collected this past summer was sort of an extension of that. We said, well, what would happen if we also pulled our young adult volunteers? They call themselves Orange Nation. There's almost 600 of them, almost 900 applied.
Mm-hmm, correct.
To come, and they spend their time serving the gathering in volunteer positions to be able to help us to be able to do the gathering well. They play a really critical role in that. There's a good enough number of them. What happens if we ask them some of these questions, and what kind of data might we get? And it was really enlightening how much good data we were able to get from that subset of young adults that really then has spurred us on to going, okay, well, now we want more.
Mark, how is this overall addressing or looking for this information among young adults, learning about them? How is this helpful to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Office of sure. National Mission Youth Ministry?
And I think some of this might come up in our conversation as we go through the data, but like Juliana mentioned, so we do this parallel track with the Lutheran Youth Fellowship with those youth participants more age 15 to 19 as well to get attitudes, understandings, theological about some things, doctrinal things within the church, as well as what are things the church needs to be talking more about. So we're able to get comparative data. How does that change from a high school student to now a college student to a young adult? As well as too, you know, as Juliana mentioned, this is something now as we're looking at a smaller group of participants, but yet a higher percentage that took actually the data. So we got great data back. But now we're looking at these young adults who have stayed connected to LCMS congregations and also are willing to give up of time and effort to be an event like a national youth gathering. So they're pretty dedicated young adults. So looking at, okay, the LYF poll might be a broader poll of general attendees of a youth gathering, where this is now a group that post high school into college, even post college, have stayed connected. And so what can we learn about, oh, this was a trend where we see this is one reason why they've said I've stayed connected to the church through these years since my high school years. And so that's really helpful for us just to see. It was stuff that we thought, mm-hmm. and we thought we knew, but to actually have data behind it to say, yep, this is something that we can see as a leading indicator.
What were the questions that we asked of these young adults who are connected and as you pointed out, mm-hmm. dedicated? There's obviously some level of dedication if they're mm-hmm. they're giving up their time to come be a part and serve mm-hmm. in this major right. event. What were some of the questions that we asked? Is this a question for Ryan?
Sure, I'll speak up about this. We asked a lot of the same questions that were asked on the LYF poll. So issues of, you know, worship attendance, Bible study attendance. But we also asked, you know, sort of probing questions about their background, the support they get from their congregation, the support they get from their parents, from their pastor. We asked how involved in terms of leadership are they with their congregation, how equipped do they feel. So we really probed into a lot of this. We also asked about certain practices, specifically dealing with, you know, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, knowing what their behaviors are, which were also asked on the LYF poll, as well as we asked the questions about their concerns and the issues that they want to talk about more, those conversations that they want to have with the church.
What were the things that you were really wanting to learn, Juliana?
Yeah, I think we were looking for those pieces. I mean, I think for us to be able to look at, so in this data, we have, you know, they're reporting more than 90% of them are in worship at least twice a month. So these are incredibly, as Mark said, incredibly active young adults. And to be able to then draw from that and go, they also report their pastors care about them personally. High percentage. My pastor cares about me personally. My congregation is supportive of my faith life. My parents are supportive of my faith life. And then for us to be able to have data that goes, congregations, look, when these things are true, we're seeing really supportive, active young people who make it through those transitions and continue to be active in their congregations and in word and sacrament. So that was a really valuable piece for us. I think for us to be able to look at how equipped they felt for leadership and ways that we can mm-hmm. better enable that. I honestly, like, we did the survey kind of going, like, we think these might be interesting
sure.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could probably talk for 6 hours on all the ways that we broke it out.
Well, let's look at one of the ways that you broke it out that was helpful to the work that you're doing
Yeah. So one of the questions we asked is how equipped do you feel equipped to serve in your congregation? And a huge majority, I believe, was something like 91% said, I feel equipped to serve in my congregation. Again, yes, do you feel equipped to serve in your community? And again, I think it was 92% said they felt like they were equipped to serve in their community. And then we asked, well, are you in a leadership role in your congregation? And only 25% reported that they're in any kind of leadership role in their congregation. And so that to me says something might be amiss. they seem overqualified and underutilized, or overenthusiastic and underutilized, that perhaps they are an overlooked resource for our congregations in terms of their energy, they're feeling prepared and ready to go out and to serve, and yet they're not being equipped or engaged by their local congregation to be able to do that.
What so far has been most significant to you, Mark, as you've gone through the research? What are some of the high points that you've learned from this?
Sure. I think for me, the interesting thing to have comparative data with the LYF poll to ask those questions that Ryan had mentioned before and Julianne had mentioned about, we asked basically how do you feel supported by groups that you would have interaction with? So it was basically parents, congregation, pastor, and then your peers. And the numbers were very positive for the LYF poll for the youth, in terms of parents are supportive of their faith life, congregations are supportive of their faith development, pastors care about me, peers support my faith. But, and again, it was something I was curious to see what would result be. Figured I would know the answer, that we would know the answer, but then the percentage was even higher than for these young adults. Mm-hmm. So even they reported a higher level, either very strong or somewhat strong, that my parents support my faith life, my pastor cares for me, my congregation's supportive. And then even I was curious about the peer piece, what would happen once they got out of the congregation and out of their high school would happen. And that, again, was even higher, that my peers support my faith life. Now, a number of these students do come from Concordia campuses, so they're certainly in a great faith development environment there. But even to see that, and that we can say, hey, they are able to select. And I think that's an important message for some of our young people too. Like, they're certainly always there to share the gospel with their friends in all places and all times and through transitions. But there's something to say to build, I think, that discipline in them, that to make sure you are surrounding yourself with people who are going to support you in your faith life as friends. Mm-hmm. And that we have these unique, special friends in Christ that understand the gospel, that understand God's grace in Jesus and support one another, and that is an important message for youth and all of us to find those friends that are going to support us and mentor us in the faith.
Julianne, would you say that there is that you've seen a correlation between relationship between parents and youth, or between youth and parents, youth and pastor, youth and congregation, and a youth's willingness to serve, a desire to serve?
Sure.
That there's a correlation between how they view their relationship with their parents, how they view their relationship with their pastor, or how they view their relationship with their congregation, and how much of an interest they have in serving others.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that we necessarily know that particular. I think we know mm-hmm. anecdotally sure. that those young people who, again, who see their parents serving in their congregation, who see their older adults who are mentors to them serving them and then consequently serving their congregation. I think that does, you do see that correlate into that. It's something that when you're young and when you're in high school, when you see that example in the people around you, it encourages you to follow that example. And I do think, you know, as we see, even as we're looking at getting to know the Yavs, is getting to know the people applying to the Lutheran Young Adult Corps, the young adults that we know from LCMSU, many of them show those similar signs. They want to serve. They are active in sharing the gospel, and they're doing it. And they're also saying, yeah, and because I'm being supported, because I know that I have people behind me who are encouraging me to do those things.
Ryan, looking at the data, did you see any trends that stood out to you as you were looking through the data?
You know, one thing that about this data that was special was that these were the young adults who were selected to serve at the youth gathering. Like Juliana said, 900 applied, and these, I'm sure all 900 were probably fantastic, and then these were the ones that were selected from that. and we see that 92% say that they're equipped to serve. The trend there is that what we recognize from that is that this is a select group. This is a prime group. And so trying to find trends in that, the trend is that these are great examples of young adults. These are what we want to see. And they do have high support from parents, like Mark said. They do have high support from pastor. In order to get trends, we kind of need to really to expand. We need to broaden the amount of people that we survey and get not just the cream of the crop, but to really expand and get a wide breadth of who all is out there. And so we need to do more research. We need to look further into this.
That's a broad and vast task.
Yeah,
that lies
it
ahead.
Is. It's very challenging to even think about how to do that.
What would you like to learn that you haven't found already in the data that you already have? What is it that you'd like to know?
All the things. I think at one point we filled an entire wall of whiteboard with all the potential questions that we could have about this. And I think that's truly, like, this is great data, but also I think it, as Ryan says, it spurred us on to go, well, we want to know a lot of these things and more from a much wider variety of young adults, whether they were raised in the church and are no longer there, and where are they, do these things hold true for other young adults who might be slightly less active or maybe just couldn't come to the gathering, and can we carry this out to other things? But I think, you know, we as a church, we talk about other research or we can speculate on some of those things, but I don't think we have the data to be able to talk about it with the kind of authority that we would like. And so we're hoping that this new piece of research is going to allow us to talk about it with a lot more data behind us, a lot more authority behind that.
So tell me about the new piece of research you're embarking on.
Yeah, so it's going to be a two-part research piece. The first one is going to come out here in just a couple of weeks, and it's going to be encouraging congregations, particularly pastors, to go back in their confirmation roles to when these young adults were their confirmads, and to look at those names, to look at those numbers, and to give us feedback that they know. Do you know where they are now? Are they still members? Are they a member somewhere else? If they are members or not members, could you get in touch with them? All of those kinds of questions for us to be able to see how, from a congregational perspective, from a pastoral perspective, what do we know or what do we not know about how those confirmats have carried on into young adulthood? And what might that tell us about what good or not so great retention looks like within the church? And then the second piece is going to follow that kind of the late May, early June, where we're going to do a large scale survey of LCMS young adults or young adults who at one point were members of the LCMS and broaden that out to as many as many people as we can get to take a much larger survey than the YAV poll to ask them the questions that we are curious about. Are you still in the church? Why? What factors might have played a role in that? What keeps you, a member of an LCMS church, or, what maybe might hold you back from having that membership? So
Ryan, are you ready for this undertaking?
Yeah, we've spent several months strategizing how we would do this, and it really starts by getting support, by building a coalition with our congregations and with our young adults and with the families of young adults. Because we don't have names. We don't track names on individual people to like that. So in order to reach these people, we need the help of congregations who know them. We need the help of parents who know them, siblings, grandparents, friends. So we're going to be taking a huge undertaking to reach out to all of you and build a team to reach those people that we know. It'll be one thing to reach the people who are still in the church and who are still passionate and connected and care, but to also reach out to family members who have left and gone somewhere else or walked away and encourage them, hey, we just want some feedback. We want to know what's going on in a non-threatening way, but in a way that they can voice their opinion.
Mark, why are pastors key in this next step?
Right. Partly, it's an interesting part, even in that survey, to go back the number of years you're going to ask them to go back, about 10 years or so, is to see, I think it would be a little bit of an interesting study about what a transitions do in leadership, in terms of what does that look like from a confirmation, making those connections for young people. And certainly, too, as pastors, as they shepherd their congregations about to, you know, how do they understand those? I mean, it is really unique situation that we confirm those young people. They're, you know, full-fledged members of the church from the standpoint of how we understand confirmation. So how are we instilling them into leadership roles? How is the pastor leading them that way as their pastor and through these times of transitions that are unique? And then I think another interesting piece too then is how are congregations understanding that kind of those young adult years, where both we even saw in the young adult data is that many young adults right now with the kind of the situation in the economy and with college and other things are returning back home. And they're back home with mom and dad maybe or nearby. And how are we reaching out to them maybe differently now in their new vocational situations and connecting with them with the church? And so how are pastors leading congregations and parents through that step of how do we talk about this differently, address this differently, reach out to them differently? And at the same time, too, I think it's a new thing with the connections we have. We see it on social media to where now when young adults who are maybe mobilizing and moving to new locations, how are we instilling in them and how are we as congregations understanding the network that we have to say, hey, I've got a young adult who now is moving to Dallas, Chicago, wherever it might be, and where's a congregation nearby that I can connect them so that they find a home that cares for them spiritually and where they can find a community there. And I think, you know, pastors are great conduits to have that connection in the ways that we have networks and things within, as well as DCs mm-hmm. and others too, that have networks within our church body to make that happen.
So a pastor-to-pastor connection.
Right.
We have a young adult from our congregation moving to your city, moving nearby, maybe close to your congregation or neighboring congregation. Mm-hmm. How can you help them make a mm-hmm. connection?
And to help pastors, I mean, I think a key thing for me, you know, again, I'm not in a congregation, but I think one thing that I would look down and say, like, those young people are still your members and we care for them and we pass them off. We talk about that with LCMSU, Pastor Zill, and the process there if they're going to a college campus. We've kind of got that, you know, on our CUS campuses that pass off. And so how do we even now the next step, if how do we help them do that and help young adults own that themselves, but then also as a church, how do we say we care? This is so important to us that we are going to make sure you get connected in a community, and we're going to do everything we can, and so that we see that pass off happen because we care about their spiritual development and connection to the church.
Hmm. What's your with this big project lying ahead? What are the questions or challenges you think? What are you anticipating with this big project ahead of you?
Yeah, I think it's going to give us insight that we haven't had before. I mean, that's our hope. Our hope is that we can get a broad sample of data and a good solid sample of data that's going to give us some insight specifically to our church body that we haven't had before that we can look at and then go, okay, what are we suggesting as best practices? How are we going to continue to care for and minister to those young people, the new young generation that's coming up? How are we going to handle that? How are we going to seek and work on bringing young adults back into our churches? How are we working to care for them maybe that have left? There's all sorts of, you know, kind of like the YAV data, there's all sorts of data that we can get from this. And we really are just hoping that by asking the right questions, whatever those responses are, then we as a church body then can both dig deeper into to examine more, but then also to go out and to share this data largely with the church body to say, this is what we know. Let's act on that in a way that helps us to continue to keep young people in our church and connected in Word and Sacrament ministry.
We only have about a minute left, and I have about a dozen more questions. It sounds to me, and I believe I've read this before in previous reports, there is a pretty notable attrition rate when it comes to between confirmation and young adult But Mark, do you know off the top of your head?
It's a little hard, and that's partly why we want to do this data, mm-hmm. too, is that we have great data on baptism confirmation, but we really don't have an official way in which we say, like, how many graduates now are in your church. So anecdotally, usually, we see it from other, like, Pew and others who do the kind of high school thing, is that it is about usually 50% drop-off from those confirmation numbers. Now, certainly there are questions to ask, well, how active were those young people before they got into confirmation in terms of it's mm-hmm. not just necessarily like, oh, we were really active up until eighth grade and we dropped off. It may have been we weren't really active until seventh grade and then we got active because of confirmation and then we dropped off again. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily have that data. But usually the kind of anecdotally piece and research from other areas is that from that end of eighth grade to end of high school years was about 50%.
Based on what you've shared with me today, it also sounds like there's probably a significant correlation between how connected or how involved their parents are
yes.
in the congregational life before confirmation.
Absolutely.
And after.
Correct.
That's going to, and I know that that's something you're hopefully trying to find.
And even after high school, from the standpoint that faith is important to my parents, even after the nest might be empty, that it wasn't, they weren't just going to church because of the kids. That this is an important relationship for me with Christ in the relationship of the church, and so that they see that as well.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Anything else about the data? I want to give you one more chance before we wrap up to talk about the young adult. I'm Lutheran Young Adult Core as well, but anything else about data as we wrap up?
No, I mean, we want to encourage you. There's certainly, we wrote a leader blog about some of this material. There's going to be an article in the Reporter that's coming out this next month that will dig into that YAP data. So if you are curious to learn more about that or want to have those specific numbers, those will be available to you. And then we just want to encourage congregations and young adults and people connected to young adults to participate in the research so that we can come back and share what we learned once we're done.
Lutheran Young Adult Core. This 10-month opportunity, you have 48 hours left.
You do. You have until April 1st.
Yes, 47 now.
Right. Well, there you go. Yes. And applications are closed for our 10-week program, but we will launch this June with our first set of summer participants. And so keep us in your prayers.
Thank you very much. Mark Kiesling, Juliana Schultz, Ryan Kernett, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up in just a little bit, what do we mean when we say father-to-be? We'll find out here on Faith and Family.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
A new study says you live longer if you're a parent. This may come as a surprise to the parent of an infant, 2-year-old, preteen, or teenager. Actually, it might come as a surprise to any parent. Researchers tracked over 1 million people and gathered information on, among other things, whether they married and had children. Their findings say men and women with at least one child had lower death risks and lived a little longer. By the age of 60, men gained 2 years and women 1.5 years. I'll leave you to contemplate why the difference. Some speculate married people live healthier lives, although I recall many family meals at McDonald's when the kids were little. In the end, I believe it comes down to children being a blessing from God.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Hi, this is Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Are you a rostered church worker with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? As a financial partner with the LCMS, we understand your unique calling and desire to stay focused on ministry, which is why you can look to us as a faithful partner when it comes to your financial needs. Our borrowing solutions allow rostered church workers and ministries to expand their spiritual work now and in the future. Learn more at www.lcef.org.
Joy has many causes and many expressions. It can be set loose by delight, also forged in the fires of perseverance. On the next Sing for Joy, you will hear music that comes from out of the depths of human spiritual experience. Join us.
Sundays at noon on KFUO.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. It happens. Someone announces they're expecting. We're all excited for them and elated. And we always say congratulations to the mother-to-be, to the father-to-be. And it's just a joyous occasion, especially for those the new grandparents as well. A little tear in their eye when they're excited about the, you know, welcoming a new life into their family. But when we say mother-to-be or father-to-be, are we saying more than just that we're congratulating them or we're excited for a new life in their family? Joining me by phone today, Jonathan Graham. He's husband, father, and Lutheran layman, studying classics and creative writing in Charleston, South Carolina, and author of 5 Reasons to Stop Calling Dads of Unborn Babies a Father-to-Be in The Federalist. Jonathan, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you with us today, and enjoyed your recent article, 5 Reasons to Stop Calling Dads of Unborn Babies a Father-to-Be. I understand you're a father. Tell me a little bit about that experience of becoming a father.
I am a father. Just before Father's Day last year, I was surprised with the announcement from my wife that we were expecting a child, and then just February of this year, my little boy, Augustine Philip, was born, which has been just the most absolutely incredible adventure of my life thus far.
As you shared that news with others, with friends, family, neighbors, those you encounter in the workplace or in school, what was the response when you shared that news that you're expecting?
Generally joyful kind of anticipation with us of this big event that was oncoming. A kind of funny phrase, congratulations, you're going to be a dad in the kind of future tense.
What made you stop and think about that?
Well, my wife had developed her pregnancy pet peeve where every time somebody found out we were pregnant or she was pregnant, they would say, "Oh, you're never going to sleep again," which is relatively true.
We parents feel compelled to share that with others for some reason. I'm not sure why.
I appreciated it because I understand that, like, our sleep cycle was definitely about to change. It was about to be a big, big shift. But the thing that got me was this father-to-be talk because it seemed to say to me, you are not currently a dad, which is to say you do not have a child. So it seemed very disrespectful to my unborn son.
When did it really sink in? After you heard it once or had heard it numerous times?
The first time I heard it, I think I was probably at work and somebody said it, and it kind of like tweaked something in the back of my head. And I was like, oh, there's something just a little off somewhere there. And after a while, I heard it from a couple of other sources, and actually something that kind of drove the point home. We used a pregnancy app to track baby Graham's development as he grew up in the womb, and they would also use this kind of future tense language to describe mothers and fathers, which was just really odd, but as I say, that's what kind of drove the point home, ultimately.
And they were well-intending, it seems.
Yeah, I don't attribute any malice to anyone who mm-hmm. uses this language. I think that this language is just so deeply ingrained in our culture as a whole that without thinking, without some sort of stop and assess, objectively, is this language describing the situation? It's not surprising, and it's not coming from a place of ill will towards parents of unborn children.
How do we define father? And what does this phrase father-to-be then do to that definition of father? Does it affect that?
Yeah, in the article, I drew from Merriam-Webster's definition of father, which I'm paraphrasing here, but it's roughly any male who has begotten a child. So to say father to be is to say that this person does not yet have a child. The analogy that I drew was kind of, it's a little bit theology nerd related. At the Council of Ephesus, the church was divided over whether or not they should agree with Nestorius, who was saying that while Mary was Christotokos, or bearer of the Christ, she was not Theotokos, she was not bearer of God. And the church kind of recognized that what you say about Mary in this case, whether you say that she was Christotokos or Theotokos, is what you are saying about Christ himself. So they sided against Nestorius and said, no, Christ has always been fully divine. Therefore, it is right to call Mary Theotokos, bearer of God. And so in kind of similar fashion here, if you say father-to-be, you are saying this is a person who in the future will be a father. In the future will have an offspring, but currently, right now, even though their child is in utero, does not have any sort of child or offspring. What you say about the father or the mother for that case is a confession about what you believe about the child.
So what does this, this really brings us to a topic that's pretty significant in our culture, the pro-life issue. Is the embryo, is the fetus a child, a human? And so what does this lead us to when we look at it from the perspective of science?
Well, scientifically, we know that and I'm not personally a scientist, I'm a studying classics, but scientifically, we know that a unique, genetically unique human individual, their life begins at conception. When a sperm and an egg come together, that is the beginning of something that is neither the father nor the mother. It's unique unto itself. And embryology texts the world around will say exactly this. This itself is not the dispute in most abortion conversations, although maybe if we focus most abortion conversations on this a little more clearly, it would be harder for people who are pro-abortion to argue their point, because at the end of the day, abortion is the killing of that genetically unique human thing that is not the mother, it's not the father, it's not the mother's body. It's an organism unique to itself. It has its own body.
When we use this phrase father-to-be about a man who has fathered a child, yet the child is unborn, what does this say then? You know, if we say that he's not a dad yet, he's not a father yet, what does this say about dads in other dads in their context? Whether they be, what does this say about the vocation of dad for someone who has never met his child face to face? A child was lost through a miscarriage.
Yeah, that is something that I think is deeply important here as well. I've had close personal friends who have had miscarriages, and I think that something that's very difficult for them has been how our culture approaches that. There's a little bit of a stigma, but at a certain point, they have felt as if the culture is saying to them, your grief is inappropriate. And especially here, if you say, oh, this is a father-to-be, and then the child is lost, well, he was never a father, so he can't grieve as if he's lost a child. Or vice versa for the mother. She was never a mother in the eyes of the culture, and so she can't grieve as if she's lost a child. And yet, from the very moment that my wife and I found out that we had this little human gestating, we were in love with them. I can't recall who said it, but I remember hearing recently that pregnancy is the relationship father and mother to child is the only relationship in the human experience in which love precedes knowledge of person. And so when you have this deep-seated love in your heart for this little guy or little girl that's growing up, and then that is lost, that love is no longer has an object. That grief that results is perfectly natural for a father or a mother. And yet, when we use this language, father-to-be, mother-to-be, it's as if we're saying what you lost was not a child. It was just, to borrow the language, it was just a clump of cells.
That love that precedes knowledge, that precedes, the knowledge of that person, it comes from vocation. What is the vocation of father? How does a father love and serve this child while he's still in the womb?
Well, I think one of the primary vocations of father is as the head of the household, like Luther's Small Catechism says. He's to teach the faith in a simple way. So right from the beginning, my wife and I spent time reading the catechism and not that we haven't done this before, but just renewing our devotional studies. As a father, I've worked to provide so that my wife can stay home with our newborn son so that she doesn't have to work sometimes. She can focus all of her energy and attention on making sure that he is cared for as best as possible. And I think that's a big thing, at least for me and for a lot of young dads I know, just the instinctual drive to provide for my wife and my child, to be there at the doctor's appointment to make sure everything's going well, to ask questions, to be engaged. But I think overall the vocation of father is basically that of provider at this stage, at least. Later, of course, you've got catechist and leader of group worship in the home, but at this stage it's really just provide and make sure that my wife is as comfortable as possible so that she can do her thing, build that baby well inside of her womb, and then take care of that baby well in a way that I just can't physically now that he's here.
So your vocations as husband and father, provide and protect, that your wife may live out her vocation faithfully, and that involves both of you protecting this child, caring for this child, that he might be safe as he's growing in the womb. What does, when we say father to be, then what are we saying about your vocation as a father during pregnancy?
In a way, we're allowing men to just abscond from their duties to say, I don't want to take on the financial burden, the emotional burden, don't get me wrong at all. Having this child has been amazing, but it has been a challenge. It's a challenge that I think has made me already a better person and hopefully will continue to make me a better person through my life. But it is a challenge nonetheless. And so if a man doesn't want to rise to the challenge, doesn't want to rise to the responsibilities he has taken on himself by fathering a child. The language of father-to-be really allows him an escape from that. I pointed to the example of Mark and Nathan Hamill, who allegedly pressured Nathan Hamill's girlfriend to have an abortion when she got pregnant. And this kind of denial of the humanity of the child gives men a way to escape and to run away from responsibilities that they have to the child. Something, ironically enough, that I appreciate is that in many states, paternity laws are such that you cannot do this. So there's this felicitous inconsistency between what we believe about children and what our law enacts about children, in that, you know, if culturally we kind of have dehumanized the individual in the womb to just a clump of cells, still there are some legal pressures on men who contribute to this, you know, clump of cells, as it were.
To take responsibility for that clump of cells.
Responsibility, exactly.
So it's this, were we to really believe this language of father to be, we're allowing men to abdicate their responsibilities, to just give up on their duties as father and protector and caregiver.
Yeah, exactly.
What good can come from this phrase, father-to-be? Is there good that could come from it?
From the phrase intrinsically, I think no. But the thing that I came to love about being asked this question was that when somebody says, oh, congratulations, you're going to be a dad, it's very easy to turn that around and ask them, what do you mean I'm going to be a dad? Because you're not in the abortion context, so people's guards haven't gone up. You're not really in the political spectrum of things. You're on a very personal level with someone. And so some people, and I have had this conversation a number of times now, some people just mean, oh, well, you're going to take the little one fishing and, you know, burp him and change diapers and that kind of thing. And so they're thinking more of the functional side of fatherhood. What do dads do? Well, you know, they go to work, they come home, they change diapers, they give baths, they teach fishing and how to build a fire and these kinds of things. So with those people, they're not denying the humanity of my child. They're just saying that functionally, while my child is in my wife's womb, I'm not changing diapers or any of those things. They're not talking about the ontology of my child. Some folks just are flat out, they don't believe that it's a child, and so they are flat out denying that that I am a father. They're, well, when it's born, you'll be a dad. And that's an opportunity to have an interesting conversation and ask them questions about, why don't you believe that this is a human being? What else would it be? Considering that it's the offspring of two human parents, that kind of thing.
So perhaps they're leaning more toward when the state identifies that you're a father, recognizes that on a official document, a birth certificate, then you're a father.
Maybe. I know that the primary part of this conversation that I've had with people where they've been on that side of denying the humanity of the unborn, generally they believe that it is not a child until birth. Granted, I'm in a college town, so the rhetoric skews rather left. So this may not be, your mileage may vary in personal experience across the states, but In a college town, there's this misconception that it's not a child until birth, that the law doesn't even recognize it as a child until birth, and things like this.
So what was a pet peeve of yours when someone would call you a father-to-be that has turned into perhaps a conversation starter.
Absolutely. And as I said, having a child has made me a better person. It turned me from this kind of selfish thinking about, oh, that's just annoying to me, to now I have an opportunity to talk to somebody about something that has eternal consequences, about the state of the unborn child, about abortion laws, and about the shoddy thinking that underpins the pro-choice side of things.
Have you had any conversations that have started in that way, that started with someone calling you a father-to-be, or you're going to be a dad, and you asking, what do you mean? And then it leads to a much deeper conversation about such things?
I've had a handful, actually. It's been a real blessing. I consider myself a pro-life activist, and I write regularly about this kind of thing and try to have these conversations. So this was a really easy end to have in those final few months of pregnancy. Quite a number of conversations at work, at school. And as I say, they're generally less combative than if you just were to flat out ask somebody, which I don't recommend, but I have done, what do you think about abortion? People's guards tend to go up a lot faster then. So I've found that these conversations not only allow less combative and more winsome tactics, but they also are more likely to be fruitful in that people aren't connecting the dots, and so they start to follow the logic where it leads, as opposed to jumping to their conclusion that we must be pro-choice for whatever reason, and then working the logic over with a blackjack to get it there.
Now that your child has been born safely, thanks be to God, and you both get to enjoy this parenthood and this wonderful sacrificial vocation of caring for and protecting a child. Have you discovered a new pet peeve when people congratulate you on your new vocation?
I don't think I have. It's just been such a whirlwind of... I mean, there's just no other way to put it.
You're just too tired to know.
That's probably it, yeah. I'm just overjoyed all the time with this little guy, so it's hard for anything to be too annoying.
For me, it's been when I and my son are spending time together and someone witnesses that, they'll say, oh, daddy's babysitting. It doesn't happen frequently these days, but it's happened from time to time, and I ever so gently point out that I'm not babysitting. I'm simply being a father.
Yeah, nobody's paying me to hang out with my son. Nobody needs to pay me to hang out with my son. That's a reward in and of itself. Yeah, that's. I haven't really. He's only 6 weeks old, so I'm sure that's a phrase I'll run into in the future.
Particularly when you venture out, and again, they're just much like the people saying father to be. I'm sure they're well intending, but it's. It's not necessarily true that I'm babysitting when I'm spending merely spending valuable time with my son.
It's a little off-putting. I can definitely see, again, that kind of subtle degradation of the vocation of father.
Apparently, I've corrected a few too many people quickly, all too quickly, one too many times. Because when my wife hears someone say it, she kindly warns them and pulls them off to the side, warning them not to say that around me.
Well, you've got a good woman.
Jonathan, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for your article in The Federalist and on five reasons to stop calling dads of unborn babies father-to-be. Excellent article. I look forward to seeing more from you in The Federalist and other places as well. Thanks for sharing your story with us, and congratulations on the new little one.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word with Pastor Whedon, studying God's Word here on The Messenger of Good News. Hope you can stick around for that as he digs in and takes a look deeper at God's Word. And also a reminder, Share-a-thon 2017, just around the corner, April 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Join us as we celebrate and give thanks to God for this broadcast ministry of Worldwide KFUO. You can pledge your support. Share-a-thon 2017, April 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Thy Strong Word up next on The Messenger of Good News.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.